Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Good to be here. Good afternoon, and welcome everybody to today's program at the Commonwealth Club. My name is David Lang. I'm the co-founder of OpenROV and National Geographic's Open Explorer, and I'm pleased to be your moderator for today's program. Joining us today is my good friend, Jason Rezaian. Currently a global opinions writer for the Washington Post, Jason spent 544 days imprisoned in Iran, a journey that he discusses in his new book, Prisoner, My 544 Days in an Iranian Prison, Solitary Confinement, a Sham Trial, High Stakes Diplomacy, and the Extraordinary Efforts It Took to Get Me Out. While working in Tehran for the Washington Post, Iranian authorities arrested Jason and his wife and later convicted him on charges of espionage. While world powers negotiated a deal on Iran's nuclear program, Jason became a pawn in a global game of politics. Thankfully, he was freed in January 2016 as part of a prisoner swap. He joins us today to discuss his story, his book, and more. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jason Rezaian to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here today, everyone. I want to welcome my mom and my wife, who are here as well. They've been huge supporters of me throughout this entire process. It's great to be here. And I'm really excited to be here on stage with you, David.
Well, me too. So we've known each other for about a decade now.
Just over a decade, yeah.
Yeah. And so I've had a kind of a front, not as close as obviously your family, but I've had a front row seat to this story. And how many people have read the book? Just a few. Okay.
Was it any good? Good. That's good. Thank you. I always have to ask, you know?
You've written an extraordinary book.
Thank you.
I have read it twice, and I think it does an amazing job capturing your story. And I think if you just picked it up, you might think this is only about being in prison. But to me, this is a very full story about how to make and create an interesting life, a story of resilience, of love, of family, of friendship. And I think that's all in there. And so what I want to do today is kind of start at the beginning.
Okay.
Or at least when I met you 10 years ago. Do you want to talk about that moment in your life?
Yeah, sure. In the fall of 2008, I was the proprietor of a Persian rug business at the corner of Sutter and Powell, just off of Union Square. I had opened my doors in May of that year, and by the time that September rolled around, when the financial crisis hit, I was bailing some pretty significant financial water, realized that being in the Persian rug business was probably not the ideal place to be in that moment in time. I had studied creative writing, and I had been a freelance writer throughout my 20s, but felt as though I needed to become more responsible. Mm-hmm. And my father had been in the rug business for a long time. You might know of him from the iconic building that he built in Mill Valley on the way to Stinson Beach at Tam Junction. That was the family business from the late 1960s until the mid 1980s. People tell me that finally it went out of business. You know, we haven't been involved in that location since the 80s. So any signage or anything that those guys did, if they sold you a bad rug or something like that, that had nothing to do with the Rezaian family. And my shop in San Francisco was one that although sales weren't high, people held in high regard. And I would do these little events at the shop around Iranian culture. I'd been spending a lot of time traveling back and forth between San Francisco and Tehran for many years. I'd do poetry nights and other sorts of cultural happenings. And it was kind of a cool place to hang out, wouldn't you say?
We had some good parties.
Yeah.
So
I just want to finish by saying that during that time, I was craving the opportunity to write more. My life was consumed by this shop that was failing, and I went to a creative writing class just to kind of sharpen my skills that I felt like I hadn't used in a couple of years at the San Francisco Grotto. Some of you might be familiar with it. And in this class, taught by a really wonderful writer named Ethan Waters, I met David. And I'm a decade older than David is. We've known each other for a decade. Mm-hmm. But we kind of really hit it off right off the bat. And at that point in our lives, both of us had kind of big aspirations for what we wanted to do, but not a ton going on.
Yeah, that's right.
I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, and you have a line in here about that kind of moment, which I thought was, which was really good about wanting to make that jump. When the world financial markets were collapsing, I decided that sticking it out in the Persian rug business would lead to personal, financial, and perhaps actual suicide. There was no second thought about where I would go. I had made up my mind that I would be starting fresh in Iran. I just turned 33. It was my Jesus year. While a lot of my friends were starting to have kids, I'm sure most of them thought I was a little crazy, although a few were definitely envious. I'm going global, I told them. And he actually told us all that. He said, I'm going global. And I remember thinking, I don't know if this is a good idea.
I mean, I wasn't sure it was a good idea, yeah. But you know, that's how my life at 33 looked. I, you know, had a really good resume as a guy who had worked in a couple of rug shops.
Right.
And you know, if you're a CEO or a director of HR in a company here in San Francisco, and my resume kind of came through your desk, I don't think I was getting a call for an interview.
Right.
So I thought to myself, what can I do? I've started this path as a writer that I always wanted to pursue, but never put myself into 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a very small body of work, and I knew a couple of editors, and there was an election coming up in Iran. You know, as some of you probably remember, the 2009 election, the re-election of the president, Ahmadinejad, which is still being contested 10 years later, was a huge moment. I could not have predicted that I was stepping into this story, but from the day that I got there until the day that I was arrested 5 years later, I was never out of work.
Mm-hmm.
And I became the lone U.S. citizen working all those years as a correspondent in Iran, more than anything because I was willing to be there and nobody else was. So
there's a great line later on in the story where the Washington Post is kind of doing a background check, checking your credentials, and they call someone to ask, so why do you think Jason is the right guy for the job? And the guy responds, well, in many ways, Jason is the only guy for the job.
True story. And, you know, I think that that was something that in those kind of dark financial days of 2008, I thought to myself, you know what? This is an opportunity. And that probably sounded crazy to almost everyone that I knew. And sometimes, as you know, those are the leaps you have to take. When you're so certain of something and everybody else is telling you, you know, whoa, man, slow down.
Right.
Either they're right, oftentimes, yeah, or they don't know something that you know, and right, you have to go with your gut, and that's what I did.
Yeah. So this went on, this kind of reporting, for a few years.
Yeah.
During that time, you would come back a few times. I know one of those times while you were back, a discussion that we had, and it turned into something much more. And this is really a product of two people who didn't have enough going on. So do you want to talk,
sure,
about the Iranian avocado project?
Yeah, it was your fault.
Okay.
No, come on. It wasn't David's fault. So, you might have seen some of the interviews or heard some of the interviews I've done in the last few days. People keep referring to this Kickstarter project that that I undertook. And it became a big part of the case against me in Iran. But how it started, as David says, was the product of, yes, two guys that didn't have a lot going on, but also two guys that were trying to push the envelope a little bit.
Right.
And I should say, are people familiar with Kickstarter? Okay. David has two of the most successful early Kickstarter projects in history under his belt.
I don't know if they're the most, but I've used Kickstarter before.
He's used Kickstarter before and has two very successful projects after the failed avocado project, which was something that we kind of conceived of together as a way to open up conversation about Iran in a different kind of way than I was seeing in the sort of reporting from Iran that I had been reading for years. It was really an attempt at trying to get people to think.
Right.
And it failed miserably.
It did. But you know what? It worked in the sense that it was a real MacGuffin. Are you familiar with that term at all?
Tell us.
So a MacGuffin is a filmmaking term. Alfred Hitchcock used it to... It's the story that starts the story.
Right.
And the thing that I felt about it then... and I guess it actually kind of played out this way, was that it fit in this very fine line, you know, between crazy and stupid, which is so crazy it just might work.
Right.
And like you said, this became an issue, something that came up after you were arrested.
Long before it became an issue and a point of interrogation, it was also a calling card.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember going to the Washington Post mm-hmm. and having interviews in 2012, so about 2 years after you and I put this project up, and I had 7 interviews that day, and we were going up in the elevator, and myself and the managing editor of the Post at the time, and he says to me, "So talk to me about avocados." And that wasn't the first time I had that conversation. So, you know, people saw it, and the people who did see it, either thought it was ridiculous and stupid, or, you know, they saw it as a conversation starter.
Right.
And my interrogators saw it as a crime. So, right. You know, yeah.
I love the line. So, you know, there's one of the first things that came up.
It's literally the first thing that comes up. They say, "You have to tell us what this is, because... we're not sure what it is, but it's got to be very nefarious.
Yeah.
It's secret code for something. Kickstarter doesn't exist because nobody would." Is that what you wanted to say?
Well, that's good. That's a good part of it.
I mean, you know, who gives money to people they don't know to accomplish meaningless things? So welcome to America in 2010. I mean, that is sort of a... They could not... wrap their Revolutionary Guard brains around that.
Yeah. So I'm just going to insert this disclaimer.
Okay.
Because it's funny now, but it was not. I was deathly afraid that this was an issue when you got arrested. And so I am like really grateful that we can laugh about it now. But I should say that I feel a lot of guilt and I apologize for my involvement in that. But so that's just a small aside. I want to publicly apologize for my involvement. But it in reading the book, in the situations where it comes up, it seems so nonsensical.
Right.
Which is kind of the truth of the whole arrest. Right? It just, it's the icing on the cake of how nonsensical it is.
Without a doubt. And I think that when I sat down to write... You know, I thought to myself, maybe I should just leave this avocado stuff out of the story, because are people going to be able to really grasp the absurdity of this? Am I going to be able to pull that off? Apparently I have.
I think so.
Because, you know, of the, you know, couple dozen interviews I've done the last few weeks, I think it hasn't come up in 2 of them. And it's been the headline in a bunch of stories. And that's good. I hope my captors in Iran look at those and realize that they're being laughed at.
Right. Yeah, there's a line that, like, later on in the interrogations where the guy goes, well, just tell us where the avocado farm is.
Yeah, seriously. This went on for months and months. And finally, my interrogator, my lead interrogator, showed up to my cell one day, maybe 6 months into my detention, with another guy, another interrogator, whose face I was never allowed to see. He had a surgical mask on and sunglasses and a baseball hat.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, okay, you know, what's this about? And they've got a paper bag in their hand, and they pull out an avocado. And said, you know, they are available in Iran now. We found one in the bazaar. We bought two, and we kept one for you. We tested the other one, and it's horrible.
Well, that didn't make it into the book. Maybe it should have. That story is just one of several that come up where you think you just had no idea what was going on. From our perspective here,
right,
we would get these sporadic news reports that were always very scary.
Yeah.
And from your side, inside, it was scary as well. So maybe you could talk a little bit about kind of when you were first in there and how like what was going through your mind and what you were thinking about and worrying about.
I think, for those of you who haven't read it or haven't, you know, seen any reports about this, I spent 49 days in solitary confinement. And that's not a laughing matter. But you don't know that you're spending 49 days in solitary confinement until you get to day 49.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I assumed the first day or two that it would... this would all fade away and everything would be resolved and I would go home quickly. But as the days and weeks started to kind of pile on top of each other and I had no contact with my wife, I had no idea where she was, didn't know if she was alive. And, you know, people say, well, that's extreme. They've done extreme things in this very prison, in this very section of the prison that we were being kept in. At first, you think that this is a mistake that will be resolved, and there very quickly, confusion turns into to fear and anger, and that's what they want,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, they're trying to, you know, disconnect you with reality, and my cell was, you know, maybe a third of the size of the stage that you and I are sitting on. I found out later that my wife was being kept in something very similar, maybe even smaller. There is a great sort of thrust to want to know why this is.
Mm-hmm.
And any time the door opens, and the door only opens if you're being taken to interrogation, you have a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that you know you're greeted with when you ask a question is you don't have the right to ask questions. You start asking questions, this is going to be much worse for you.
Mm-hmm.
And they're threatening death and dismemberment and continue to do that right up until the end. I would say that confusion sets in first,
mm-hmm.
real fear second, and then the challenge is how do you maintain some semblance of hope that this is ever going to end?
I want to read a passage that I thought that struck me as important. If you haven't spent significant time in prison, you've missed one of the essential aspects of the human social experience. You're lesser because of it. At least that's what I kept telling an imaginary audience while I struggled through each day. The world becomes a hybrid of the life in your memories, turned fantasies, the one you used to inhabit, and this, the life you never imagined you'd be forced to endure. Another thing you have in prison is nothing to do. So you think about everything. One of the things that was really interesting to read was about your resilience and about all of these mental kind of tricks you were trying to pull to keep some semblance of sanity in this situation.
Yeah.
Can you talk about some of those like tricks or?
Yeah, I didn't write about this in the book, but I've got a friend from high school. You met him, Ryan. Oh. And, you know, he's always inventing games, you know. And while I sat there in prison, I thought to myself, okay, I don't have any, there's not, a bouncy ball to, throw against the wall. There's not, pen and paper to draw pictures. There's nobody to play a game against. The only kind of tool of a game that I have is my brain. Mm-hmm. So I did whatever I could to make a lot of lists of experiences, lists of places I'd been. I tried to occupy my time with remembering experiences and facts, putting things in order. And then at some point I realized, okay, I also have to, and this is something that I learned after the fact, that I was really doing myself a favor. I need to move. I need to physically move. And it's, when you're in such a confined space, your initial thought is not to get up and pace. You know, your initial thought is to kind of retract into a corner. Right? And they want you to retract into that corner. And I didn't want to do that. So I got up and I walked. And I just, walked back and forth this 8.5 by 4.5 foot cell. And I counted. And I counted, the number of times I paced. And if I lost count, I started over. And, they were obviously surveilling me because sometimes they would come and tell me to stop walking. And later they told me, this is our most definitive proof that you're a spy. Somebody trained you to walk while you were just like, it was a combination of keeping myself active, not letting myself go down mental, traps that led to bad places. And then using whatever human contact I had, even if it was people that were threatening death and dismemberment, to maintain a little bit of humanity through contact, but also to glean as much about my situation as I could, figure out ways to ingratiate myself to these people who wished me only harm. Mm-hmm. And I think I was fairly successful at it.
Well, that's what I took away. And then also how the situation changed you. Obviously, you were out of solitary, and then you had a cellmate.
Yeah.
So I thought that relationship that you had was touching. Can you talk about him a little bit?
Yeah. So, on day 49, I come out of solitary, and they tell me to gather my things. I mean, my things were a toothbrush and two kind of rough, almost burlap blankets, and a English translation of the Quran that they had given me after about 40 days, which I read, and I read it, and they told me, okay, let's go, and I thought to myself, where am I going? What's going on? And they took me to an adjacent building to where I was being kept. And there was another guy, and he was wearing the same kind of clothes as me, and he was, scared. Couldn't speak any Farsi.
Yeah.
Couldn't speak any English. Was speaking a language I couldn't understand, and nobody right. else around could understand right. either. And then they just kind of pushed us into this room, and it was a bigger situation, and there was a door, and the door was open, and there was a couple of stairs that led into a concrete courtyard with very high walls around it, but it was fresh air,
yeah.
right? And so we thought to ourselves, this is pretty good, but we couldn't express that to one another, other than a thumbs up. In that part of the world, thumbs up also means, another finger sometimes too. So, I said, no, the good thumbs up, As I tell my wife, American-style thumbs up, right? Because sometimes she gives me a thumbs up, and I said, American-style or Iranian-style? Sorry to my Iranian friends in the front row. I apologize. Put that thumb back here. So we had, you know, we didn't know it at the time, but we were embarking on, you know, an incredible friendship.
Right.
Without any tools to build a friendship with. Ultimately, we ended up spending 13 months together.
Wow.
And by the end of it, we had figured out a way to communicate with one another. You know, I know a few words of Azeri Turk now that I didn't know before. He knows some Farsi and some English. He doesn't know which words are Farsi and which words are English. Doesn't matter, you know. He was released just about 2 months after me. It was the day that he was released, I'll never forget. It's a big day in my life. It was March 14th, 2016. It was the day before my 40th birthday. And it was also the day that Yegi and I met President Obama.
Huh.
And we came out of that meeting and I turned my phone back on and I had a picture sent to me from his son of, you know, of my cellmate Mirsani and his little daughter Homera, who, you know, was 2 when he was arrested and was 4 when he got out. So we spent a lot of time together, 24 hours a day for, you know, many months.
Sharing meals. It seemed to be a highlight, the meals.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of like a cross between that scene in Goodfellas and Hogan's Heroes, you know, our life together. We would, you know, his family would travel the 700 miles from the Azeri border to Tehran. And, you know, they weren't allowed to come very often. So when they were able to bring, you know, some treats from home. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, sitting down to some Azeri pastries and, you know, vegetables that his wife had grown in their garden, it felt like a lifeline,
yeah.
You know, and it was a lifeline. And we had a TV, right? We had an Iranian state television, which plays a lot of garbage. But it also plays Hollywood movies. Mm-hmm. And there's a channel that plays documentaries, and these documentaries are kind of cut up, you know, and mm-hmm. censored sometimes. But I'll never forget one documentary that we watched. I don't write about this, but I'll tell you about it. Was the Jiro Dreams of Sushi. Anybody seen that one? Great, great movie. And so we're sitting there and I'm, you know, listening to this in Farsi, you know, it's the middle of the day. He doesn't know what's going on. They're in a subway station and there's a guy cutting some kind of meat and people are eating it and chopsticks and all of that. And he says to me, you know, in our kind of hybrid language, what are they eating? Said, it's fish. I said, that's not fish. I said, yeah, it's fish and rice. So what's it called? It's called sushi. Never heard of it. He looks at it close. He says, is it raw? I said, yeah, it's raw. That's the whole point. It's really good. Oh, that's impossible. So that, you know, we filed that away. We spent thousands of hours watching, you know, all manner of whatever was on that TV. And a month or two after his release, I get a message. He's got 2 nieces who speak, you know, pretty good English. So they, you know, write messages for us. And there's a picture, a photograph of him with a big plate of sushi in front of him. And he said, you were right. It's really good.
Incredible. So I want to talk a little bit about the circle of people around you, the immediate circle.
Mm.
Yegi, your mom, Ali, and all the stuff that they were doing. And then, you know, friends and therefore, and those circles out. But you began to have contact with them as well.
Yeah.
And so you started to be able to piece together kind of what was going on. How much, how important was that to be able to see them and to talk to them and...
Look, I think when you're put in a situation like I was, some of us would like to believe that we are tougher than we are.
Yeah.
And for me, I realized fairly early into this time that it was more important for me to learn how to to survive these days, weeks, months in a healthy way and protect my mind. Mm-hmm. So I was doing everything I could to, you know, get as much comfort as possible in a very uncomfortable situation. And so those meetings with my wife and later, you know, with my mom, it was essential to me to hear what was going on. I mean, I would ask over and over again, you know, what happened this week? You know, and some weeks there wouldn't be any news, mm-hmm. but other weeks it would be, you know, a mixed bag, mm-hmm. you know, Muhammad Ali issued a statement calling for your release. And I think to myself, my wife just made that up. She wants me to feel good. But then, you know, I hear from a guard or an interrogator that, you know, we saw this on TV, and then Iran's propaganda media responds with attacks on the American government and on the Washington Post for manipulating Muhammad Ali into supporting this spy. I mean, but every time they would say something, and I learned this because on this TV I had, you know, Iran state news.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially from the middle of my imprisonment onwards, they talked about me a lot. And in really harsh tones. And I've been covering that country long enough to know, you know, they need to react to something that's going on outside. Mm-hmm. This is a response. Mm-hmm. Their negative response, their calls for my execution, their, you know, ridiculous claims against me are their feeble response to what I only could hope was a massive outpouring of support in my favor in the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be true.
Right.
So, you know, I always had doubts. And obviously there was so many things that were done secretly to get me out. Some of them I recount in the book because I've been able to interview the people that were involved. But I didn't know that aspect of it, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was always this fear of, you know, being like the guy in, you know, a movie on, you know, you're on a deserted island and, you know, the plane goes by.
Yeah.
You know, and you're trying to,
right.
you know, build a smokestack or whatever, you know. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't forgotten. And, you know, I think about the people who are still in prison there, in the same prison that I was. There are Americans, six of them right now. There's no lines of communication open between the two governments at this point. And I don't see any way that they're going to come home until there are. You know, and I feel like I've put the worst of the psychological scars behind me. But, you know, what I do have are, you know, not frequent, but periodic nightmares. And it's always the same thing. You're supposed to get out and you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only imagine what it's like for those people who have spent, all of them now, frankly, much more time in the same prison than I did.
Mm-hmm.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
Well, that kind of leads into something I wanted to talk about, in that I said at the beginning, having known you, this story, your life is really incredible. And only so much of that made it into the book. Mm. And I think one of the things that didn't make it into the book was after. So you get home.
Mm.
I mean, there's a lot of great stuff about how you got out in here,
yeah.
which is really an exciting read and interesting. But afterwards, because it's not just like, okay, you get out and you get to put your life back together. You're all of a sudden front page news.
Right.
So you go from this one situation to another completely bizarre, surreal situation. So can you talk about that, the juxtaposition, and how you tried to keep some sanity in that moment as well?
Yeah. I mean, I think those first few weeks, right after we got out, I just accepted that I was on a crazy roller coaster ride.
Yeah.
And that the previous 544 days was, you know, a lot of these kind of loop to loop things. And now I was on this other, it was just a ride. It was a ride. I mean, you know, we were taken to the military hospital in Germany, and the lawyer representing the Washington Post came to me and said, Jason, Jeff Bezos would like to come and pick you and your family up on a private jet and accompany you back to the United States. Would that be all right? And I'm thinking to myself, of course that's what's going to happen. This is like, this story is so weird already. The richest man in history is, you know, personally wants to fly over and spend time. And he did. And we did. And, you know, the thing that I've tried to do in all of these situations, not only with him, but with many other people of varying levels of prominence and lack of prominence, mm-hmm. just try to keep my humanity and, you know, acknowledge theirs. That's the bar that I've set for myself. Yeah. You know, not look at anybody as anything other than what they are, and try and realize and always remind myself that there's going to be crazy ups and downs in life, and I have plenty of experience to remind you of that. I mean, I have. My dad's no longer with us, but at some point when I was about 20, you know, he had a lot of great sayings, you know. He was kind of an Iranian Yogi Berra in some ways. and I never knew if it was, you know, because his English was a little lacking in early fundamentals, or if it was just kind of who he was. And I think it was a combination of the both. But, you know, one day he said to me, son, if you worry, you're going to die. If you don't worry, you're going to die. So don't worry. And I mean, I was 20 at the time. I don't remember what I was worried about. But I know now that no truer words have ever been spoken.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the other things that I've noticed, and I'd love to hear your opinion on this, right after when we talked pretty soon after you were out.
Yeah.
And then periodically over the years, and you were thinking about writing. Mm. You had to get back to it and build that muscle again, and writing this book and thinking, is it still going to be relevant? Those are the question you're asking. And, you know, am I not going fast enough telling the story? And I think one of the things we talked about was just having this sense that it was going to be more relevant. And one of the things I've noticed in your story is at the beginning, there was this will, this I'm going to go, I'm going to do this. And what's happened now is this bigger responsibility.
Yeah.
To talk about the experiences you had, to talk about the people who are still there, to talk about press freedoms around the world. How does that responsibility weigh on you? If at all.
It does. I mean, it weighs on me heavily. And I want to credit you for, you know, throughout this time of where I was at, you know, kind of antsy at certain points, you would say to me, I just have a feeling that, you know, come January 2019, there's going to be reasons that this is more important. We can't know what those are. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is not a story that's going to, you know, fall off. I never expected to be a poster child for press freedom issues. And I didn't actively look for that, but that's been handed to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've seen press freedom trampled on here and in other countries. And I know firsthand what happens when somebody's silenced. Mm-hmm. And I also know what it's like to get your voice back. So I take it as a real responsibility to speak up for people. And, you know, I'm not giving away any trade secrets here. when I tell you that, you know, when people ask me all the time, like, why does the Washington Post and the New York Times only cover, you know, Trump? Why don't they stop? If you all stop clicking on those articles about Trump and click on ones about press freedom issues, there'll be a lot more issues about press freedom. It's, you know. So, you know, I want to credit the Post for giving me the opportunity to write about those stuff, when, those issues, you know. I'm writing about people who are in trouble, journalists who are in trouble around the world. And they've given me, you know, real free rein to do that because they recognize the importance of that. And on the issue of people detained in Iranian prisons, I get people writing to me all the time saying, you know, why don't you write more about people in American prisons? And my response is that those are very important issues. I'm not an authority on those, but I am kind of an authority now, whether I like it or not, on being imprisoned, falsely imprisoned inside the Islamic Republic of Iran as a foreign national. And I hope that you'll forgive me for giving a damn about that issue almost more than any other, because it affects me and has touched me in such personal ways and continues to affect my family. But I don't think that I'll stop with these two issues. There's so many other things that I want to go out and write about and explore. But this has given me an incredible opportunity to focus on things that matter. And, you know, the murder of my colleague Jamal Khashoggi last fall, and really the non-response by the U.S. government has been something that's kept me up at night and continues to. So, you know, I'm going to keep working on things that matter, and I have the luxury to do that, and I feel pretty good about it.
Well, that is actually that the question about how the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi has affected, that was one of these questions that just came up. So I want to take that opportunity to remind folks that there are question cards. So if you have questions, you can send them over, and I think someone's going through and filling them in. But I do want to turn to these now because some of them are quite good. Can you talk about what Anthony Bourdain meant to you?
Yeah, for sure. You know, you mentioned feeling some guilt around the Avocado Project. I've had other people, you know, send me messages these last couple of years that, you know, you and I had an exchange several years ago about bringing students to Iran, and, you know, I worried that that became an issue. Yegi and my appearance on Anthony Bourdain's show was taped 5 weeks before our arrest. It had absolutely nothing to do with us going to prison. It never came up. But I think from the moment that that news broke, people just assumed, a lot of people just assumed that that was the cause or the reason behind our arrest. And I know that he dealt with questions about that. And I had the opportunity to sit down and talk with him in a really kind of, you know, an informal interview, but it was just him and me for a couple of hours talking about this. You'll notice that it was his imprint that is the publisher of my book. He went on to become, outside of my family in the Washington Post, I would say, you know, the single most important advocate for us while we were in prison. And the, you know, the push from him and his team to get that episode to air more and more, and people responded to it, put an awareness around Yegi and I that that people wouldn't have had otherwise. You know, there's no replacing footage of us with, you know, arguably the most beloved television personality of our generation. And then after the fact, and this is what people don't know about, not only did we have this incredible advocate, we had an incredible friend. And, you know, he was all those things that people say about him. And not everybody loves him. You either love him or you don't love him. And my wife and I loved him and will always love him. And, you know, I will be a evangelist for his work and memory for the rest of my life, because he stood by us like nobody else.
Cool. That's a slightly different topic. What's your favorite thing about being back in the Bay Area? Because you grew up here.
I did. I'm born and raised.
We were just talking about that backstage, because I think if you just like glance at the story, Washington Post journalist,
right,
prison in Iran, you think this is something that happened halfway around the world, but a third of the book takes place in California.
Yeah.
In Northern California.
Yeah. And San Francisco. It's tough because, you know, there's a lot of people that I want to see. There's a lot of places I want to go, and there's a lot of great things I want to eat while I come back to the Bay Area every time. I've had an opportunity to see a lot of loved ones. I've been back and forth across the Golden Gate Bridge a couple of times. I've been here for 3 days. I haven't had a burrito yet. So I'm hoping that I get one in me before I leave town. But it's always nice to come home, because people are not only familiar with our story, but incredibly gracious and welcoming. And as much as, you know, Yegi and I enjoy our life in Washington, D.C., where we live now, you know, I don't have to tell you all what a wonderful place this is.
We don't have the Arctic polar vortex going on.
No, no.
Which is a nice plus. I thought this was an interesting question. What do Iranian youth think of America?
It's a very good question. I think, you know, the youth of Iran is a group of tens of millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a lot of different opinions about the world, their place in the world, and the United States of America. I've found in my many years of traveling to and living in Iran that the people of Iran, young and old, were by and large the most pro-American in the sense of connecting with American people. I'm sure that there are people in the room who have spent time in Iran and will agree that their reception was really warm and people were hospitable. I think, and I just published yesterday a piece about the travel ban and how the travel ban is affecting Americans who are married to people from the affected countries, mm-hmm. most specifically Iran. I think some of our policies are making it so that Iranians are genuinely wondering what the American system, what problem they have with them,
mm-hmm.
right? And I don't think we've adequately answered that question. So I think that there's a lot of goodwill. There's a lot of desire to come and to connect with American people, culture, education. There's a desire to welcome Americans to Iran. But, you know, there's some questions that need to be answered in how we interact with the youth of that country.
You know, that reminds me of what you would say, you know, back in 2009 or 2010, which was, you know, you had strong opinions about how Obama at the time and how we should go about with those relations. And and obviously we've taken some different steps in the past few years. And this question is there a way back for U.S.-Iran relations?
I think there are. I mean, I think there are many ways, but we have to consider them as a, you know, a larger and more nuanced set of policies. You know, a government in the U.S. has the right to take the foreign policy approach that it does to any country. Same time, we have a responsibility to stand up for certain ideals that are supposedly American values. And there was a time not too long ago, you know, my father was a product of this, when Iranian students made up the largest number of foreign-born college students in the United States, right? And that continued into the 1980s. There's been a massive drop-off in the past 10 years or so, and now it's almost none because of this travel ban. So, you know, by cutting off the society-to-society ties, you're making it almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there's ways to undo that and rekindle. It's not too late, you know, and I would hope that people in positions of power in Washington are considering them.
This question also came up in the interrogation.
Uh-oh.
And so I want you to, if you can, tell the story. Are there plans for a movie? And who do you want to play you?
Well, I don't want to give it away because I think that's a good part of the book. I have been approached several times over the past couple years about the possibility of doing that. We haven't, you know, agreed to anything yet, but there's apparently a fair amount of interest. I do have somebody in mind who will play me, but I don't want to give it away. I think it's pretty good, right?
You leave it in the book.
I'll let you guess.
That's fine. We can leave. It's a great part of the book, but that whole scene is pretty fantastic.
I thought so.
Because not only do we learn who you want to play you in the movie, we learn who your interrogator wants to play.
I'll tell you
him.
Who he wants.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll tell you who he wants. He wants Will Smith.
That was fun. That was a funny part. I was actually surprised how often when I was reading that I was laughing. And it wasn't just laughing. I cried in moments, and I think the book has so much more than just kind of those prison scenes. I think there's so much depth to it. And so I think but the humor was the one that surprised me.
Well, you know me.
I know. That's what I was just going to say. Your writing, that's your writing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a coping mechanism that, yeah. You know, if you have the opportunity to tap into, you should.
Right.
And, you know, in writing this story, I thought to myself, what am I trying to accomplish here? Mm-hmm. There's several things I'm trying to accomplish. One, I'm trying to tell this story. Two, you know, you don't get a lot of cracks at writing a memoir. So, you know, I want to make this more than just about going to prison.
Mm-hmm.
Three, I don't want people to walk away from this thing feeling sorry for me. Because I just don't want that,
mm-hmm.
right? And four, I want you to walk away knowing a little bit more about Iran than when you started.
Mm-hmm.
And that hopefully in doing so, I'm not making anything worse for the people of Iran than they already are.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause they've been fighting an uphill battle for, you know, some people would say decades, I would argue centuries. So, mm-hmm. You know, give them some credit for the role that they play in the world and that they play in my story. That's mm-hmm. what I tried to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've been giving people a warning.
Uh-oh.
Before I've been recommending the book.
Yeah.
Not only because you're my friend, but because I think it's a fantastic book.
Thank you.
But I've been giving them a warning. I've been saying, make sure you set aside like 3 or 4 hours because after you read the first 7 pages, you're not going to want to put it down. I think it reads as a just kind of...
You and my mom agree on that. That's pretty cool.
I call it the 7-page challenge.
Yeah.
You can put it down after that. I'm impressed. You know, I was at an event last night. I've heard some of these interviews, and I think there are some questions that are important to go over just to get your opinion on. Is it safe as a tourist to visit Iran? Would you recommend it?
Look, I think I'm the exact wrong person to to weigh in on that.
Because for years,
yeah, well,
you were trying to get us over there.
I was, and you know, I just before the talk, a couple of friends stopped by. Here they were literally the first Americans that I helped visit Iran back in 2009, and between 2009 and 2014, I you know helped in various ways dozens of Americans and hundreds of people from Europe and other parts of the world to visit Iran because I thought it was a good thing to do. I think the truth is, and I know the Commonwealth Club has in the past. Led trips to Iran, a lot of organizations do. I can't recommend it until, you know, the Iranian government stops taking foreign nationals hostage, which is something that they started doing 40 years ago and haven't stopped. And apologize for that. And B, do more to ensure the safety of people visiting that country. The truth is that the vast majority of people that go there as tourists have no problems whatsoever. Mm. But those guarantees aren't in place.
Someone asked this question, a variety of it, last night, which is, one of my dear friends is in prison in a similar situation, and I want to know, A, what we should do now.
Yeah.
Like what works? What's the playbook? And the second thing is, can you talk about your mindset afterwards? So if they do get, like, how best to interact and how.
So I would say that, you know, from my experience, the most important thing in bringing somebody home from imprisonment, specifically in Iran, mm-hmm. Is to raise the awareness here in the United States. Because you cannot expect the Iranian regime, if they've taken somebody who hasn't done anything wrong, mm-hmm. whose only crime is that they're a national of another country, and, you know, the expectation from the authorities who've taken them is that they're going to get something in return, you can't expect them to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, many, many cases of people who are still stuck there now, who've been stuck there in the past. There's always something that they get out of it. So, you know, raising the issue here in the United States, first and foremost with the member of Congress who's involved, because that's oftentimes a family's first link with Washington. In our case, you know, we had a lot of help from people in the media, but Congressman Huffman from Marin County was essential. He met with you know, people in the Iranian administration who would visit New York. You know, he met with high-level delegations of Iranians and lobbied for me, and also with the Obama administration, made it clear that, you know, you can't let this guy be forgotten. So it starts there, and I also think that whatever you can do to make the person known to the public at large, right, certainly helped me. Mm-hmm. Very few people in the United States that have any doubt about what I was up to in Iran, what kind of person I am, what my past was about, because people like you and, you know, my friends and family did a great job of making clear, this is what Jason's about, this is what mm-hmm. he was doing, here are facts to back it up. Mm-hmm. Which is what, you know, the regime in Iran never has mm-hmm. in these cases. What was the second part of the question?
It was, so...
What can you do when they come home?
Yeah, exactly.
Just treat them like the person that you remember. And you know, it's a struggle getting yourself back to who you were before this happened. And 3 years on, you know, I doubt that I'll ever be exactly the same person. And it's a really delicate balance of... your loved one who's been locked up wanting space, but also wanting to be checked in on, mm-hmm. right? You've done a really good job. So thank you very much.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you back. What gave you the most hope during your imprisonment?
I think the hope of returning to my life with Yegi and building on the life that we already had, knowing that it wasn't going to be the same mm-hmm. As the one that we expected. I never totally lost hope. And I'm really grateful that that's how it was. And she made that possible, you know? I mean... At one point, she said, you know, you might be here for 10 years, but I'll be here when you get out. And that's pretty good. You know, everybody should be so lucky.
So I highlighted a line that your dad said to your mom before they got married. It's, I can't promise that it's going to be easy, but I can promise that it's not going to be boring, which is actually what Obama said to...
Really?
Michelle, yeah, very similar. Did you make a similar warning?
Yeah, did I tell you that?
You told me it's going to be a roller coaster.
I'm a very honest person.
So what next? What, you know, you're on this book tour. What does your life look like going forward?
First and foremost, I'm going to see if Will Smith is available to play my interrogator in the movie.
I think if we keep this message up, I mean, we've got Muhammad Ali.
Exactly. We got all kinds of people in our corner here. I want to take this book to corners of America that it might not get to otherwise. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we're blessed here in the Bay Area to have the opportunity to talk to people from different points of view and be receptive to people from different places and experiences. But there are parts of the country that I'd like to go to and talk about my experiences. And I think that if you've written one book, mm-hmm. You'd be either an idiot or a masochist not to write a second one, because you learn so much in the process. That, you know, you could do it such a more efficient job. So I'm looking forward to writing more books, and probably not about personal experiences, but maybe. I mean, you know, I stepped back into a very strange period of time in this country. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't one that we could have foreseen mm-hmm. On the day that I was released. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think there might be something there.
Something Yegi told me was that after she met you, she thought, and by the way, the scene of meeting and you two falling in love was, I also thought that was one of my favorite parts of the book.
Mine too.
But she told me this recently. This wasn't in there. She said, she thought, you know, this guy, I think he's going to have like an important role to play in these kind of discussions between Iran and the United States. And she had that sense just after meeting you. And I remember you saying that to me in 2009, saying that you feel like you have you feel like you have something to say and you have a role to play in this. Do you feel like you've said what you needed to say?
Some of it.
Okay.
And I think that the fact that at that moment in time when, you know, my two countries, I'm a citizen of both, mm-hmm. Were closer in terms of not necessarily putting all of the past behind it and starting a new relationship, but, you know, physically and you know, more engaged than they ever had been, that I would get taken captive and become a sort of a symbolic piece in this fight. It's kind of tragic. And I don't want that to be the last word of my experience with Iran. As I've said several times today, I mean, the last thing I want is for anything worse to happen to the people of that country than already have. And I think that there's things that I can offer to the larger conversation about it, because it's not we always talk about these things in very stark comparisons of good versus evil. And if you've ever stepped out of the front door of your house, you know that that's not how life works, or you should. And, you know, I'm just trying to fill in the nuance that I can about a part of the world that, you know, few of us will ever get to. And I'll keep doing that as long as there are opportunities and ways that I can.
Well, I know, I think I speak for everyone when we say we hope these aren't the last words we hear from you. So
thank you.
Thanks, Jason.
Thanks, David.